Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a special holiday episode, part of our 12 days of the Comic Source. And today I'm going to be talking about Christmas with the Superheroes from DC Comics 1988. This is the sort of the first time DC had returned to doing these holiday specials that they had done previously in the mid 70s. And this particular issue is a bunch of reprints from other stories that had been told at various places in DC Comics history. And some of them are really classic. Some of them maybe you never heard of. So there's a Batman story called Wanted, Santa Claus Dead or Alive, from the DC Special Series number 21 from 1979. We also have a Justice League story, The Man Who Murdered Santa Claus, from Justice League number 110 from March, April of 1974. So I got to think, if that was the cover date, that it came out in January. That one's kind of strange to me. March, April, that's March 1974. That's my birth month. So that one's kind of interesting to me to see the sort of thing that was going on in Justice League when I was born. We also have Teen Titans. This is the original Teen Titans in the Teen Titans Swingin' Christmas Carol from Teen Titans number 13, January, February 1968. There is a Legion of Superheroes story, Starlight, Starbright, from DC Special Series number 21, 1979. That's the same issue as that Batman story. And that DC Special Series was basically a previous Christmas special, if you will. It wasn't titled, as a Christmas special. It was obviously DC's special series, but it was, filled with holiday stories. A couple others here. Superman in Twas the Fright Before Christmas from DC Comics Presents, number 67 from March 1984. And finally, we finish up with another Batman story. This, perhaps one of the most famous holiday stories ever in DC. From Batman number 219, February 1970, The Silent Night of Batman. So the other thing that's kind of interesting about this issue is it's edited by Mark Waid. And this was before Mark had really made a name for himself as a writer. He was just an editor at DC at the time. And he writes about being poor and having first moved to Los Angeles and how it didn't feel like Christmas, being 1984 and being 84 degrees outside and sunny and really not feeling like there was any Christmas in the air. And, he was just sort of a poor kid in L.A. Pre-credit card days. He said his place looked like Gandhi's first apartment. He had a chair, a radio, and a nightstand, and about 12,000 comic books. So he talks about how he went digging through those comics and found a bunch of holiday stories, and despite the Spartan appearance of his apartment and being alone for the holiday, he did feel a little cheered up. He did experience some holiday cheer by reading those holiday stories. So he wanted to sort of bring it back to DC and start up that tradition again of having these holiday stories. And we start here in 1988, as I said, by collecting a bunch of these stories in this DC Christmas with the Superhero special. The other thing that I like about it is on that page where Mark gives his retrospective, there are signatures from everybody that was working in DC at the time, I'm assuming working in the DC editorial and executive offices. So there's a lot of cool names here that you might recognize if you're a longtime DC fan. I see Karen Berger. I see Renee Wittestatter, Denny O'Neill, Dick Giordano, Terry Cunningham, Paul Levitz, Jeanette Kahn. So it's a real sort of who's who of DC personnel here. So and I have to imagine a lot of them, if they were to look back on this page with all the signatures, it would bring a smile to their face. Like there's Mike Carlin, Joe Orlando. So yeah, just real who's who of talent and people who love comics and DC Comics, and in particular is Brian Augustin, Mike Gold. So yeah, just a ton of really great people that worked at DC at the time. So let's go ahead and dive into the issue. The first story, as I mentioned, Santa Claus Wanted Dead or Alive, Batman story. And this Batman story is really significant because this is the first time Frank Miller ever worked on Batman. He didn't write it. It's written by Denny O'Neill, but we have Frank Miller handling the pencils, Steve Mitchell doing the inks, Ben Oda on letters, and Glenn Whitmore on colors. And so the story starts off and Batman is thinking about how Christmas or no, crime goes on. Somebody even stole the star from this nativity scene that Batman sees as he's swinging over the city, thinking, well, I can't be concerned about that now. I've got bigger problems. And he heads to a club where, and this is pretty interesting, it's owned by Mr. Lasko. And they call him Matty Lasko. And I just have to wonder if this is Denny O'Neill kind of poking fun at Martin Pascal, who was a comic creator that worked at DC right around the time this story came out. So I think it's got to be Matty Lasko is sort of a stand in for Marty Pascal, which I just think is fun when creators throw in other, you know, other people, real life people they know make an homage. But anyway, this club owned by Lasko, they're sort of celebrating Christmas, having some drinks. Batman shows up. He interrogates him. He wants to know why Lasko arranged a boat to be waiting in Gotham Harbor tonight. Lasko, you know, ever a tough guy. Oh, I'm not going to tell you. He has a Stooges attack. And of course, Batman dispatches him in pretty quick order. And after Lasko tries to punch Batman himself and nearly breaks his hand, he gives it up. He says, I done it as a favor for my old cellmate, Boomer Katz. So Batman then heads undercover to kind of a soup kitchen, and he's kind of asking around, anybody heard of Boomer Katz, wonder what he's up to. And he gets a little information that he hears Boomer has been employed recently as a Santa Claus at a department store. And as Bruce leaves, he says to one of the workers there at the soup kitchen, I got places to be, take this and use it as you see fit, as he heads out. And when the woman opens it up, there's $1,000 in there. So Batman, as he changes out of his disguise back into his costume, is thinking the only reason that a heist artist like Boomer Katz would get a job at a department store is to rip it off. So he heads over there to try to stop that from happening. At that very same moment, Boomer Katz is indeed finishing up his shift as Santa Claus at Santa Land at this department store. And the store owner, Mr. Jackson, is thanking Boomer for his work. He's saying, you're the best Santa we've ever had. And it really seems to touch Boomer. He's like, you know, thanks a lot. And he's having second thoughts. When he gets outside, he's met by these ne'er-do-wells who he's made this agreement with to disable the alarms. And when they ask him to confirm that he has, he says, I couldn't. Everybody there was so nice. The kids made me feel so good. I can't go back to being what I was. And Fats, the leader of this gang, says, well, we're going to do it the hard way. You can't back out on us. You know, we had an agreement. And he pulls a gun on Boomer. And they at gunpoint, they lead him back there and make Boomer knock on the door. Mr. Jackson opens it saying, oh, Boomer, did you forget something? And Fat says, yeah, he forgot something. All right. He forgot to grab the day's receipts. So Boomers is, apologizing as these thugs hold Mr. Jackson at gunpoint, saying, you know, they forced me and, you know, I had no choice. And so these thugs decide they're going to take care of Boomer once and for all. So Boomer kind of throws some Christmas ornaments or bells that are on the table there at them to try to escape. He gets shot at and does get hit. Fat says, let him go. We'll handle him later. But right now, we need to get the money from Mr. Jackson. So Batman has arrived at Lee's department store. He hears the gunshots from outside and crashes in through the window. He's able to subdue Fats before he can do anything to hurt Mr. Jackson. And then he grabs a fake Christmas tree, maybe a 2-foot Christmas tree, little Christmas tree, maybe off the shelf, and flings it at the other gunman and knocks him out. And then asks Mr. Jackson, where's Boomer Katz? And Mr. Jackson says he ran out back. They said something about Boomer having double crossed them. They're going to murder him. And meanwhile, the third thug has caught up to Boomer, and he's got his mouth covered and says, "Not a peep. You'll keep your mouth shut. You'll live longer." And he's actually hiding in that nativity scene that Batman swung by earlier in the issue on the first page, because there's a couple of cops out front. And so, you know, if I'm Boomer, I'm probably screaming bloody murder as much as I can with the guy's hand over my mouth, because they said they're going to kill me anyway. So what do you have to lose? But he does stay quiet as Batman sort of arrives on the scene, and with Mr. Jackson along with him, they're both looking for Boomer, and they see the police officers. They ask if they've seen anything, and they say no as the police officers move on. And Batman is kind of standing there with Mr. Jackson, and they're kind of at a loss where to search. Like, they could be anywhere at this point, when all of a sudden there's a bright blazing light. And Mr. Jackson says, "Batman, you know, what are you looking at?" Batman says, "The star. It was missing just you know, a little while ago, and now it's back, and its rays are pointing here, you know, sort of behind the nativity scene." As he jumps back there, he sees the crook with the gun on Boomer and dispatches with him pretty quickly, and helps Boomer to his feet. And Boomer says, "Yeah, I'm fine. Only that star, it's gone again." And Batman says, "Well, gone home, Boomer." So obviously the implication there being that star was the famous Christmas star that heralded the birth of Jesus Christ. And we have a scripture here from the Bible to sort of finish off the story, saying, "To give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet into the way of peace." So it's a pretty interesting story. You know, it's kind of fun. Just one of those old school Batman stories, very typical of the time, but with a Christmas bent. You know, certainly seeing Boomer sort of, you know, embrace his rehabilitation and do the right thing. And then Batman obviously doing his thing as well. So it's in the spirit of Christmas, probably not the most heavy-handed or over-the-top Christmas story, but probably suits Batman at the time. And then again, as I said, a lot of people feel the significance of it being the Frank Miller artwork, his first work on Batman. And if you're familiar with Frank's recent artwork, this is not going to be recognizable as his work. And it's not even the best of his work by any means. I'm sure even he would admit to that. But it's solid. It's much cleaner. The anatomy is much more traditional than Frank's work later on, where it becomes a little more stylized. I think particularly the best panel in the whole story is when Batman grabs that Christmas tree that I was talking about and hurls at one of the hoods, because we get sort of some double exposure here of Batman in there's basically three Batman in the panel as he grabs it, swings it, and then hurls it. So that's done really well, kind of shows some real dynamic action to Miller's art. And there are some times where the art gets a little visceral, it's a little textured. And I think it kind of heralds, as I said, the skill with which Frank Miller will kind of grow into as time moves on. All right, let's move on to the next story. It's that Justice League story I was talking about from my birth month. And Superman flies in the window as Batman's waiting for him. And he says, "Hey, you know, you're right on time." Apparently, they're about to have some sort of Christmas celebration. We see a Santa Claus who is getting ready, putting his hat on and his beard, and Superman's asking him, "You ready? Those orphans won't wait all evening." And he says, "I'll be with you in a moment, Superman. I want to look exactly right." And all of a sudden, there's an explosion. This is pretty brutal stuff for being, you know, sort of a kid's comic from 1974. And Superman and Batman are like, "Oh, are you all right?" "Yeah, I'm okay. But what about Santa? He was in the room where the bomb went off." And as we turn the page, the Santa's laying there. He's dead. They actually murdered Santa Claus. So, yeah, this isn't for the faint of heart. I don't know that you would want to give this to a little kid. You know, we have the title page there, "The Man Who Murdered Santa Claus," as Santa Claus is laying there, his body smoking. And Superman and Batman are like, "Wow, there's nothing we can do for them. Santa Simpson is dead." And Batman says, "If I didn't know better, I'd swear the key to his killer is in his hand." And that could be a little foreboding there indeed. And we do indeed see a key in his hand, along with a note saying, "To the Justice League of America, a Christmas gift to you from me, a very extra special key. Beneath the arch, it fits a lock that once it's turned will save a block of city folk, both mayor and bum, from being blown to kingdom come. So waste no time. Don't hesitate. You have till 12 to find the gate. This key will fit, though I admit, I think you'll be too late. Signed, an admirer. So this story comes from writer Len Wein, the late great Dick Dillon, and Dick Giordano, artist Glenn Whitmore on colors. Julie Swartz, editor, with a special thanks to Green Lantern fan Duffy Volano. So they start to try to solve the case. They call up the rest of the Justice League with their signal beepers, and we get a little page here of various panels of the members of the Justice League. Remember, this is the satellite era where they have their headquarters above Earth in a orbiting satellite. And a few people are unavailable. Flash is in the future, spending the holiday with his wife, Iris. Ray Palmer has totally forgotten that it's even the Yuletide season, as he's involved in the exploration of a sub-microscopic universe. Meanwhile, Ralph Dibny, the elongated man, along with his wife, Sue, are off the Caribbean coast, out of reach of the JLA receiver because they are scuba diving. And Aquaman is presiding over the undersea city's sacred festival of lights. But there are a few Justice Leaguers who are available. Red Tornado, John Smith, is enjoying a casual stroll through snow-draped Central Park. So he makes his excuses to his lady friend, Kathy Sutton, and heads to the satellite. Dinah, Lance, and Oliver Queen, Green Arrow, and Black Canary are, boyfriend, girlfriend, and they hear the signal and immediately head for the satellite as well. And then finally, we see Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, who has just gotten into the shower and says, "It never fails. You step into the tub and somebody's bound to call." And for all of Hal's, superheroic prowess, he steps out of the tub onto a piece of soap, a bar of soap that's on the ground, slips, falls, bangs his head on the tub, and is knocked unconscious. So doesn't really do much to sort of, give that superheroic feel and how manly and graceful is Hal Jordan, right? So the ring, sensing that Hal Jordan is in trouble, as well as this crucial call from the JLA, flies into the bathroom and it bathes the owner in its emerald light, as it says here. And it ascertains that the damage done to him is minor, and failing to arouse him, surrounds him with a healing aura, then streaks off into the night. So I always think it's kind of funny the lengths that writers go through in the story to use one of the substitute Green Lanterns. I mean, it's fine. I like the way things are nowadays, where there is Hal Jordan and there is Guy Gardner and there is John Stewart and there is Simon Baz and Jessica Cruz got like five Green Lanterns from Earth. It's great. But in the old days, there always had to be a reason, right? Like, why can't it be Hal Jordan? I mean, I don't know why they didn't want it to be Hal Jordan, wanted to be John Stewart, but regardless, here we go, right? Like, let me bathe Hal Jordan in this healing aura, and the ring can fly off. The ring is so much more sentient. It's not just a tool here. It almost has a life of its own. So indeed, it does streak off and find John Stewart, and he's showing some friends in the ghetto, the urban ghetto that he lives in. This where I'm standing is where the building whose plans I've worked on for months is at hand. And the ring, slips onto his finger. The Green Lantern costume appears, and he flies off as the ring is telling him, "John Stewart, alternate Green Lantern of Space Sector 2814. You are needed." And John's trying to object, "Wait, what if I don't want to go?" But it's too late. He's flying off into the air. So meanwhile, at the JLA satellite, we see Black Canary, Green Arrow, Batman, Superman, and Red Tornado already there, saying, "Well, I guess this is all that's going to show up. Let's go ahead and get started." When a voice off panel says, "Close, brother, but no cigar. You better add Green Lantern to the roster of the present." And a couple of the heroes are sort of taken aback. They're like, "Wait, you might be wearing a Green Lantern uniform, but you're not Green Lantern. Tell us how you got in here." And John Stewart's like, "Easy, hold on, just be cool. This ring will tell you anything you need to know." And Oliver Queen says, Hal Jordan told me about this guy a couple times, Superman, so let him talk. And the ring explains, I've been programmed by my master, if he's ever unavailable, to answer your summons to secure John Stewart and bring him here instead. And so John Stewart says, yep, that's the story. The regularly scheduled Green Lantern has one monumental headache. So you have me in his place. And Oliver's complaining. Oliver Queen during this period of time is a real grump. And he says, wow, what a miserable way to spend Christmas Eve. And Red Tornado being an android, pardon my asking, Green Arrow, why is this particular evening different from any other? And Green Arrow's like, what, it's Christmas, man. That's why. Don't you understand? Like, how can I explain this to a machine? Red Tornado says, well, my artificial origins, you know, the fact that I'm a machine, they haven't impaired my capacity for learning. So, you know, if you're unequal to answering my question, just say so. I'll understand. Green Arrow's kind of fuming in the background. It's like, unequal? Why, you lobster face? And Batman's like, ah, that's enough. That's enough. All right. Let's devote our energy to the problem at hand. And John Stewart asks what the problem is. Batman explains the death of Santa Claus, talks about the clue, the note that was left with the key. And that note, if you remember, it said beneath the arch. And so they figure that to be the St. Louis arch, and the block, the city block that is set to explode must be in St. Louis. So they all head there. They're not sure what they should do. If Flash had showed up, he'd be able to take the key and try it in every lock in the city in a very short period of time. But he's not there. So I'm not sure why Superman can't do that. You know, it's always the Superman Flash race. Who's faster? But regardless, Red Tornado says, I can do it. You know, he's pretty fast when he gets moving, but he might not necessarily be able to try it in every lock. And John Stewart says, well, hey, here's what we'll do. I'll zap the key and change it into sort of this Geiger counter sensitive artifact. And whenever a Red Tornado gets close to the lock that it fits, it will signal him. So sure enough, Red Tornado streaks around the city, and he's just about giving up hope. There's only a few blocks left, then the key starts to go off. It starts throbbing like an overactive heart, and Red Tornado summons the rest of the League. So as they're about to enter this crumbling building in sort of the bad part of town, if you will, some kids show up and they're saying, hey, you got any spare change? You know, they're cold. Hey, can you help a brother make it through Christmas? And they're specifically appealing to John Stewart. And he's like, oh, well, I wish I could help you, little fellow, but they don't put pockets in these outfits. And he says, why don't I use the power ring to whip you up some? And Green Arrow's there to remind him, hey, you know, the Guardians don't really allow that kind of thing. You know, you want to help these kids, make sure they're still around for Christmas and help us, you know, defuse that bomb. So it's a reminder things are a little different back then, too. The Guardians were very much these kind of big brother types that, you know, you could be in the middle of a mission as a Green Lantern and do something you didn't like, and they would just pluck you. They would just, you know, grab you and pull you to Oa against your will because, hey, you weren't following the rules, right? You were using the Green Lantern ring for selfish, what they saw as selfish purposes or trivial, you know, purposes. They were all about the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. So anyway, John Stewart realizes that Green Arrow is right. So he tells the kids, maybe a little bit later. You know, I got to go do this thing and, you know, I'll look for you after. And so as the Justice League enters the crumbling building, we see a figure in shadow who's watching them. And the first thing they notice is that it's pretty run down. You know, it's like, man, this place looks like the underside of a rock is how Green Arrow describes it. And John Stewart, you know, again, sort of being the at that time in DC Comics, along with Black Lantern being, you know, the token underprivileged, you know, minority. He says, welcome to the inner city, ladies and gents. If you think this joint is bad, you should see some of the filth holes I've had to live in. And Superman says, well, you know, let's discuss real estate merits later. We really have to locate the bomb. And all of a sudden, a trapdoor opens and they all fall through, which, you know, it's interesting. You talk about these very superpowered beings and their they fall for things like trapdoors. I mean, Green Lantern can fly, Red Tornado can fly, Superman can fly. Why do they all fly through the trapdoor? It seems like when the trapdoor opened, they would just immediately, instinctively start to fly. But instead, they all fall down, and they're in this kind of small silo, and they check, make sure everyone's okay, no broken bones. And all of a sudden, there's a miniature sun that's descending toward them. It's yellow, so Green Lantern's power ring has no effect on it, and they can feel the heat coming off it already. Green Arrow's worried that they're getting coal in their stocking, hot coal, and Superman says, not only is it descending upon us and it's yellow, the radiation from it is actually red, and so it's sapping my powers. I've got to destroy it before it's too late. And he gets in an argument with Green Arrow here, there, in this, you know, deadly situation. And Green Arrow, ever the grump, arguing, you can't, are you out of your mind, Superman? Without your full superpowers, that thing has you outmatched. It's gonna, you know, kill you. And Superman arguing back, well, at least the rest of you will have a chance. If anybody else tried to destroy it, they for sure would die. Maybe I can survive. And again, it seems so out of place for today's sort of Justice League, right? Just different era. So anyway, Superman doesn't even have the strength to fly up, even though it's only been a few seconds. He doesn't even have the strength or power to fly up to the sun anymore. So Green Arrow and Batman sort of link hands, and Superman runs toward him, jumps up, and they and lands on their hands, and they sort of fling him up toward the sun, and he is able to defeat it, but apparently he dies in the process because he's been blown to smithereens. Green Arrow wondering where is he? What happened to him? Batman saying, I'm afraid I know. The explosion blew Superman to atoms. And I will say that the expression on Batman's face, you know, even through the mask, you can tell he's feeling a little emotional. But now that the sun's gone, a doorway slides open in the side of the silo, and they all head out into the next room and the next trap. So there's a kaleidoscope, a circus calliope, actually, I should say, that's playing music on its own, and it's spewing out gas. And the room is sealed away. There's no place for Red Tornado to sort of, you know, disperse the gas to. He says, my companions are doomed. You know, obviously, it's not going to affect him being an android. And Black Canary thinks, well, Tornado's right. It's a long shot, and I'm not even sure I still have the power, but if I can hit just the right note to counter the Calliope song, maybe it'll stop the gas from spreading. At this time, if I remember correctly, Black Canary was having a hard time. Her vocal cords were damaged. She was having a hard time singing and using her superpowers. So you kind of wonder why she's there at all. But she is able to, for the first time in months, it says, throw her head back and sing a silent ultrasonic melody that forces the choking fumes away from the gasping Justice Leaguers. So now they can breathe again. We see a door open in the wall, slides open, and all the Justice Leaguers, with the exception of Black Canary, head out. And Green Arrow says, come on, Dinah, we got to move fast. She responds, I can't. My ultrasonic song is the only thing holding back the gas. I have to stay, which doesn't really make sense. Like, run through, like, keep singing as you back up, and then you're right next to the door, and then you just step through, right? But that wouldn't be in keeping with the story. We have to have, you know, sacrifice here. And so, sure enough, they leave her behind, and Oliver's not happy. You know, he's banging on the door, the steel door, trying to get through, saying, we've got to get back in and get there. She needs me. And Batman saying, you know, pull yourself together. The door is impenetrable. There's nothing we can do. We can just keep moving forward. We have to stop this bomb from going off. And so we see, once again, a shadowy figure who says, as you have observed, sir, two of the Justice Leaguers have fallen. Do you wish me to continue? And now we find out who's behind this after all. It's an old Justice League villain called The Key. And he responds, yes, of course I want you to continue. How do you expect me to beat the rest of the Justice League? I want them to all be as dead as I am. Because, my friend, when the Key slithers off this mortal coil, he's taken as many as he can with them. So apparently the Key, longtime classic JLA villain, is about to die. And so the next trap in the next room is a bunch of bouncing giant Christmas ornament balls. And the various Justice Leaguers are using their powers to sort of divert them and keep from being smashed by these giant balls. and they're sort of bouncing around the room, and Green Arrow is about to be hit by one from behind. Batman doesn't have time to warn him, so he tries to kick it out of the way, but he gets sucked in to the ball and disappears. So another Justice Leaguer down, and Green Arrow at this point realizes that the balls are attracted to heat, so he pulls out a couple of incendiary arrows and lights them in his hands, and it attracts all the balls to him, which then once again we see the sliding opening of a door as the trap has been defeated, but this time only John Stewart and Red Tornado are able to escape. Batman and Green Arrow both haven't been taken out by giant balls. The next room, the trap is a bunch of life-size toy soldiers, and Green Lantern and Red Tornado are able to dispatch a couple of them pretty easily, but after their initial attack, apparently the density of the soldiers increases and their color turns yellow. So with that density increase, all of a sudden Red Tornado is not able to kind of knock them off their feet with his wind powers any longer. And obviously the Green Lantern ring of John Stewart can't affect anything yellow. So just as they're about to be overcome, we see a portal once again sliding open behind them, even though they haven't defeated the trap. And they wonder who saved them and why. So they're in a tunnel, and they're wondering, I wonder what happened. You know, this portal opened up, it's sliding shut, cutting off the soldiers from behind us. They had us. I don't understand what happened. And Red Tornado says, you know, I don't either, but maybe the answer awaits us at the end of this darkened tunnel. Meanwhile, back in the control room of the key, he's watching everything unfold on the monitors, and he missed John Stewart and Red Tornado escaping, and his assistant is saying, "See there, sir, as you will observe, all the remaining members of the Justice League have been destroyed." And the key is celebrating, saying, "I swore I'd have my revenge on those fools. I swore I'd outlive them all, and well, most of them anyway, and by thunder I have." And then we get sort of a recap here of the last time the key faced off against the Justice League, and Superman wanted to put him in the Fortress of Solitude in suspended animation, but a judge felt that would be unconstitutional, and instead he got 20 years to life. But as it turns out, his life sentence was much shorter than that, because a routine examination by the prison doctor revealed that the chemicals and various things that the key had injected himself with over the years had caused cellular damage, and he was dying. So he actually got released early because they only gave him a year to live. So they paroled him to allow him to live out his last days in peace. But of course, being a supervillain, he couldn't have that. Don't want to die in peace. Instead, he swore that he would defeat the Justice League before he died. So he congratulates himself on the murder of a dime store Santa Claus being the clue that led the Justice League to his special death maze. He'd been planning it for a long time as a unique Christmas gift to himself. His last gift, the destruction of the... And as he's about to finish his thought, we see a voice off panel saying, "Forget it, brother! The tag on that gift should say you can't open it till Christmas, and it's still a few minutes before midnight." And we see that Green Lantern and a Red Tornado have survived, as have Black Canary and Superman, as the next door slides open. Behind the third door is Green Arrow and Batman, and the key can't understand. He says, "You're all alive. Am I hallucinating? How?" And once again, voice off panel, "How, Scoundrel, is simple. I am the reason the Justice League survived your diabolical schemes." And the Justice League themselves are surprised, and they say, "Of course, I should have realized. It's the Phantom Stranger. Only one man who could constantly be in the right place at the right time to save the lives of each of us." And Phantom Stranger, you know, at this time in DCU, is sort of this enigmatic figure. The Justice League are constantly trying to get them to join. He seemed to have like nearly this omnipotent power. And, you know, there he is in his three-piece suit with his cape and his his fedora, his face in shadow, and he says, "I deserve no credit, Batman. I was just performing an act. You most certainly would have performed yourselves had I not been here, and when the opportunity presented itself to replace the keys underling, I took it, and it was nothing more than that." And so the key says, "No, you can't ruin me this way. I won't let it. I won't let you spoil everything." And he decides he's going to set off the bomb. As he heads towards the levers, the Justice League try to stop them, but he throws up a yellow force field at the last moment that prevents the Justice League from stopping him. So he has started the countdown. The block is going to blow. So the key actually escapes through a trap door, and he says, "Admit it, heroes, you've blown it. I've won. The key has won at last." And the Justice League don't have time to chase him, because they have to go and stop the countdown. They have to go and rescue everyone, because they find that they can't stop the countdown and the bomb is going to go off. So why Phantom Stranger, who's super powerful and has these magic powers, couldn't just stop the countdown or stop the key from starting the countdown, I don't know. Story purposes, I guess. And so the Justice League do manage, with their incredible powers, to evacuate this entire city block from being destroyed. So with only a few seconds left, John Stewart Green Lantern is flying above, and he says, "There's only a few more seconds till the key's booby trap wipes this whole neighborhood off the map. Justice Leaguers have saved all the local residents. I guess it's up to me to save the rest of the city from the shockwave that will go off when the bomb explodes." And so he puts a giant force field bubble over the city block, and as it explodes, when the smoke clears, all the buildings are still there. And Green Arrow's thinking, what happened? Those buildings should have been destroyed. Look at them now. I swear they've just been built. And John Stewart answers, they were. Because remember, I don't think it was Crisis. I think it was maybe Final Crisis or maybe Flashpoint. John Stewart was an architect rather than a Marine, like his backstory has him now. But at this time, he was an architect. So he says they were. It's against the Green Lantern's code to give these folks new housing, which makes no sense whatsoever. But he says, I just used the ring to reconstruct the old buildings the instant they were destroyed, minus the roaches, rats, collapsing ceilings and such. So I didn't give them anything new. I just sort of prevented them from losing what they had. But he says, these old tenements are clean and solid as the day they were built. I promised these kids a Christmas present, and they got it. And Green Arrow says, yeah, that's fantastic. Who says they don't make things like they used to? I got to hand it to you, Green Lantern. And John Stewart's kind of surprised by that, taken aback. He says, what, Green Lantern? It's the first time you've called me that since we met. And Green Arrow, finally not grumpy for once, well, maybe you finally earned it. So Batman says, I hate to interrupt this exchange, but anybody notice that in the heat of the past few minutes, the Phantom Stranger disappeared again without saying if he'll accept our offer to join the JLA? I guess he just stopped by to give us a little Christmas present of his own. So, again, Phantom Stranger, super powerful when he needs to be, when it suits the story, but then couldn't stop the bomb from being triggered. And, of course, never does join the Justice League, at least not that I know of. Anyway, we do get an epilogue here. This is kind of, even though it's just a one-page epilogue, it is sort of significant. Because before this, prior to this, Red Tornado had a truly terrible costume. He was literally just this red android without really any sort of features except for, the bare minimum. His face kind of looked like Iron Man's first suit of armor. It was, a couple of eye holes, a mouth, some bumps for ears, and a bump for a nose. But right here in this epilogue, he gets the costume that we're much more familiar with, the red, yellow, and blue costume. And what's interesting is, so even though it's just a technically a costume, right? So instead of just being this plain red android with this grayish purple cape, it's now much more dynamic. It's got these yellow stripes. It's got a blue cape with a much more dynamic collar, yellow gloves. Just much less plain, much more dynamic looking. But his facial, like literally the shape of his face changes as well, which doesn't make any sense. Because how would a costume, change its fundamental structure? But regardless of that, his face, it does become much more human looking. than previous. And so this is a change, and the costume and the look that many more people are used to seeing a Red Tornado in. And so he received the costume as a gift from the rest of the Justice Leaguers. And we do have Oliver Queen playing the role of Scrooge here, saying, "Humbug, you know, why are we giving him this gift?" And, you know, Dinah, she says, "I was just too tired of that drab, grim outfit you've been wearing." And this one does look a lot better. And Green Arrow is very, very happy, but saying, "I still understand the purpose of you giving it to me." And you know, Black Canary is trying to explain to him, "There's no purpose. It's Christmas. You know, you give people something because you care about them." And we see Green Arrow sort of rolling his eyes. And even as Dinah and Superman continue to kind of explain to Red Tornado what Christmas is, Green Arrow's had enough. Like, just wish him a Merry Christmas and be done with it. And Superman and Black Canary reversed by, like, "Wait, am I hearing right? What did you just say?" He said, "I said Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas. You want to make something of it?" So kind of funny. But as Dinah gives him a kiss on the lips, saying, "Oh, Oliver, you've made enough out of it for all of us. Merry Christmas, sweetheart." We see Superman turn toward the reader in the last panel here, saying, "Merry Christmas to everyone." And that's where the issue ends. So kind of a fun story. Interesting to go back and look at these type of stories because, you know, the sensibility is so much different now. The heroes, I guess you blame it on power creep, why they seem so much more powerful now. Maybe the readers are more sophisticated now. They need to be more powerful. But like I said, killing Santa Claus on the first page is not for the faint of heart. And yet, even with that added seriousness, there's plenty of corniness to go along with it in these older comics. And this isn't even Silver Age. You can't even blame it on Silver Age kookiness. You know, this is early Bronze Age stuff. So speaking of kookiness, right here on the cusp of Silver Bronze Age, we have the next story, Teen Titans, A Swingin' Christmas Carol, art by Nick Carty, script by Bob Haney, color by Helen Vesick. And yeah, when you talk about these old Bob Haney scripts, they are something else. Filled with a lot of, I guess, what he thinks is relevant talk at the time. I have a hard time believing that people even talked like this back then. But apparently they did. But this goes back to something else I've said before. When you put in slang and sort of topical speech, you really run the risk of dating your work, because when people read it later on, it like, "Wait, what?" It really can pull them out of the story. So the Nick Carty art, it's classic Nick Carty. You know, people with giant eyebrows and textured looking backgrounds and such. So that stuff's really great. But we start off, we're in the Junkorama junkyard with Mr. Scrounge and his assistant Ratchet. And so again, clearly the take on A Christmas Carol, a swinging take on Christmas Carol, the classic from Charles Dickens. So what we learn through the course of the story is Mr. Scrounge runs this scrap heap and is just as tight-fisted as the Ebenezer Scrooge we know from the story. And Ratchet's son, Tiny Tom, is confined to a wheelchair and is working really hard and working extra time so he can buy the automatic wheelchair for Tiny Tom. It's coming up on Christmas, and Scrounge runs Ratchet off because he has a meeting with these men. And again, can't think about this too logically, but these men supposedly are here to drop off a bunch of junk at the Scrounge junkyard scrap heap, so to speak. So these men are paying Scrounge to leave them to their own devices in his junkyard at various times. And what they do is they dump all their junk, and then they pull out a gizmo to pull the big switcheroo. And they work for somebody named Mr. Big. And what Mr. Big does is he arranges to have all this junk sent from overseas. And then he uses this gizmo to pull the big switcheroo, which turns all this junk back into brand new goods. Brand new expensive stuff that he can sell at big profits without paying any duty. It's foolproof. So why does it have to be brand new stuff that is then somehow destroyed, and then with this gun to pull a big switcheroo? Seems like, wouldn't it be easier just to go buy junk for next to nothing and then pull the big switcheroo to return it to its natural state? But again, you can't think about it too logically. You'll just, you know, it's a comic book, right, from 1968. So they celebrate their latest haul, saying, yeah, using Scrounge's layout here as cover is foolproof. That old buzzard will do anything for a buck. But unbeknownst to these two henchmen, their latest adventure here, their latest use of the big switcheroo and the gizmo was seen by Tiny Tom. And he thinks, wow, they're smugglers, and Dad's boss, Mr. Scrounge, is helping them. I gotta tell Dad. So he does indeed tell his dad, and his dad says, I don't know that I should go to the police. I think it's better to talk to Mr. Scrounge first and give him a chance to explain. Obviously, Ratchet's worried about losing his job, worried about getting in trouble himself. And truth be told, Scrounge doesn't know anything about this. He just knows he's taking money from these guys to let them use his junkyard each night. And when he finds out, he says, what? You accuse me of criminal activities? You're wrong. I just rented my junkyard to businessmen. What they do with it is their business. And Ratchet's trying to appeal to him, but what they're doing is illegal. We should call the police. And he says, no, it's none of your business. Utter one more word and you're fired. And I think you'd better work Christmas Day after all so I can keep an eye on you. And so Ratchet then heads home and tells his son, you know, I can't risk losing my job. How would I take care of you? How would I buy you an electric wheelchair? I promised your mom before she died. Please understand. And Tiny Tom says, I do. While thinking to himself, God, Dad's under the stingy thumb of Mr. Scrounge. How can I help out? So what he does is he contacts his friends. Apparently he knows the Teen Titans. So we see Robin, Kid Flash, Aqualad, and Wonder Girl, and they're on the edge of the junkyard, talking to Tiny Tom, keeping the place under surveillance, and with Robin saying, that is quite a story, the smuggling racket that turns junk into valuable goods. And as they're watching, they see, oh, here comes a truck, here come those goons again. So they all stash away on the back of the truck so they can observe what happens. And once again, it's the two henchmen about to pull the big switcheroo with the gizmo when all of a sudden the two henchmen are attacked and attempt to flee. And the Teen Titans aren't the ones behind the attack. And they wonder, what the heck's going on? And so they bail out of the dump truck and follow the shadowy figure who attacked the henchmen. And here's where we get some of the really funny dialogue. One of many times in the issue or story where Aqualad says, mumbling mantas. But really, Bob Haney, really? Anyway, they follow the shadowy figure to Mr. Scrounge's house, where he's banging on the door, and he says, Ebenezer Scrounge, I have returned. And Ebenezer's like, wait, that voice, it can't be. And sure enough, when he opens the door, it's Jacob Farley. And he says, it's not possible, you're not real, you're a ghost. He's in traditional prison garb, you know, the white and black striped clothing, if you will. And Farley explains that he has escaped from prison, and he was Scrounge's partner, but now he's as good as dead. He's a convict because he took the rap for Scrounge. Scrounge sold some defective material to somebody who got hurt on the job, and he alone was blamed. And he's like, I didn't know the material was bad, but Scrounge fixed it, so he was in the clear, and I took the fall. And Scrounge explains, well, I didn't know it was bad either, and why should both of us go to prison? Then we would have lost our business. And Farley doesn't believe him for even a minute. So This is all explained to the Teen Titans, and they're kind of wondering what they should do while Scrounge gets on the phone and says, you know what you should do is you should leave. I'm calling the police. They're going to come for Farley, and they're going to toss you Teen Titans out of my house. I haven't done anything wrong. With Aqualad responding once again, mumbling mantas, what should we do? And Robin says, well, there's not much we can do. We don't have a choice, right? Farley's a fugitive and we are trespassing. So they leave, but not before Farley jumps out the window and escapes as well. So they're not sure what to do, but Robin says, you know, this visit here tonight gives me an idea. Haven't you characters begun to dig it yet? Ebenezer Scrounge, Jacob Farley, Tiny Tom. And Aqualad responds, I dig it. Scrooge, Jacob Marley, Tiny Tim. It's just like Dickens' Christmas Carol. Merciful Minerva, says Wonder Girl. It is. So Robin has a plan. They're going to take a page from Charles Dickens to try to get Scrounge to change his miserable ways. So the following day, which is the day before Christmas, Ratchet's heading to work, and Tiny Tom is saying, God, he's such a pathetic, unhappy man. I feel sorry for him. And Ratchet's saying, you're right, Tommy. You're the greatest, nicest kid in the world, and I'm lucky to be your dad, and heads to work. So soon at the Junkorama office, Scrounge is being his typical self. Ratchet, work faster. You're wasting money. You're lazy. You're afraid of hard work. And before too long, it's Christmas Eve night, and Scrounge sends Ratchet home and realizes he's going to have a delivery showing up once again at any moment to be paid off by the henchmen so they can pull their old switcheroo. So as he's waiting, he hears some noise, and a phantom comes through the wall and says, Ebenezer Scrooge, I'm the ghost of Christmas past, and shows him a picture of himself and Alice. And Scrounge is thinking, she jilted me. She married someone else. Please, you're breaking my heart. I'm just a poor old man trying to get along. And the spirit's saying, look what you've become. You're once young and handsome and popular. And now you talk about being poor, you're loaded. I must go, but beware, change your ways before it's too late. So Scrounge, that's gone. The spirit's given me a chance to escape and reach home safely. Apparently he's not going to wait for the henchmen anymore. And once again, we see the next spirit show up. It's the ghost of Christmas present, saying, I'm here to show you how your stinginess hurts others. And he says, what do you point at, spirit? Said, I'm pointing to Bob Ratchet's home. He can't go home yet. You pay him so little. Here he is searching your junk for things to fix his crippled son's wheelchair. And Scrounge, once again, it's not my fault, you know, blaming other people. The boy can't walk, and I had nothing to do with that. And the spirit says, but it's your fault. His father must work even on Christmas Day, can't afford an electric wheelchair to move about. And what about your partner, Jacob Farley, taking all the blame? You better change your ways before it's too late. Scrounge saying, please, Mr. Spirit, heartless old man, I'd never hurt anyone. And as we see the ghosts of Christmas future fly in, obviously being Wonder Girl, Scrounge starts hearing voices. I heard old Scrooge died, or Scrounge died, rather. Yeah, good riddance, old skinflint, no one misses him. Lucky he died now. The police were closing in on him. He was mixed up in some crooked ratchets. And all of a sudden, he hears Tiny Tom's voice. Hey, all of you, stop. Scrounge wasn't all bad. He was just unhappy. There was good in him. I feel sorry for him. And Scrounge thinks Tiny Tom's voice speaking up for poor old miserable me. So it seems like the Titans' plan is actually working, when all of a sudden the Hoods have shown up with their delivery. And this time they've brought Mr. Big himself. And their arrival pulls Scrounge out of his reminiscing and his thoughts. And he's thinking, oh, Mr. Big himself is here. And as the trucks pull in, they see the chick in the air, the ghost of Christmas future, or Wonder Girl, and they fire at her, knock her out of the sky, and she's revealed as being Wonder Girl. Scrounge is like, the jig is up, the spirits, I've been tricked. It was the Teen Titans all along, as Robin, Aqualad, and Kid Flash come running up, with Aqualad and Kid Flash still in their spirit robes. Not sure why they didn't bother to take him off. So here we go. Here's the fight. Howling Hogfish this time is the call from Aqualad as they try to save Wonder Girl. Like, what, you know, why is the girl the one that needs saving? Pretty typical 60s comic here. So they manage to pull Wonder Girl away from the danger, but one of the thugs has gotten to the magnetic the crane with the magnet on it that's used for moving junk and turns it on. And because of Wonder Girl's magnetic bracelets, she's attracted to it, and then she gets dropped into the car crusher. So they're attempting to take care of her by using the car compactor. Robin manages to knock the guy out of the crane before Wonder Girl can be crushed, but then apparently another one of the great contraptions here by Mr. Big, along with his switcheroo gizmo, they have some sort of trap, and they turn it on, and it's not magnetized or anything, but it somehow can differentiate between who it wants to attract with what seems like magnetism and who it doesn't, because none of the other hoods are trapped by this gizmo, but Robin is, and Flash is, and Aqualad is. They're all sucked into this thing, yet nobody else. So I'm just not sure how it's supposed to work. But all the Teen Titan boys are trapped, and as Wonder Girl recovers and tries to rescue them, she becomes trapped as well. And now it's time for the hoods to take care of the Teen Titans once and for all. But then Tiny Tom shows up and says, "You think I'll make you free the Titans?" And he rams into one of the hoods. But they knock him out of his chair, stomp up and down on his chair, and destroy it. And that's when Scrounge finally has had enough. He's saying, "No, don't." You know, he's remembering Tiny Tom having stood up for him. And he goes and he turns the trap off, and that releases the Titans, while Tiny Tom looks on saying, "Atta way to go, Mr. Scrounge." And Scrounge, to his credit, he doesn't run away from the fight either. He destroys the trap with an old bumper from a car, so it can't be turned on again, and the Teen Titans quickly dispose of the other hoods, as well as Mr. Big himself. So once the hoods are all knocked unconscious, Scrounge sort of looks around. He sees Mr. Big's hoods unconscious there. He sees the smashed wheelchair of Tiny Tom, and he tells the Titans, "You know, when I saw Mr. Big smash it, I became a changed man. Tiny Tom, who defended a miserable skinflint like me, and I'm going to remain a changed man. Your dad won't have to work tomorrow, Tommy. In fact, he's getting a big raise, and I'll do my best to get my partner Farley's sentence reduced." And the Titans are very happy that their plan worked. And not only that, they pick up the gizmo and pull the old switcheroo on Tommy's wheelchair and turn it from an old crappy wheelchair into a new automatic wheelchair. So, again, why did the hoods have to smuggle stuff in? Couldn't they have just bought junk or given money to Scrounge and then just walked around his graveyard turning the junk into new? Don't think about it too much. So final page here, the Titans all celebrate their good fortune and the fact that their plan worked, and we get some really bad dialogue once again. Caption box on the top: "So now here's our Teen Titans Christmas card in fab 4-color Titan scope. Send it to a friend, he might be an Ebenezer Scrooge too." Wonder Girl is asking Twinkle Toes, that being Kid Flash, how he likes her Santa outfit. He says, "Gear, WG. I'd hang out my stocking, but maybe he'd only fill it with junk." I'm not sure. Gear, that means it's good, I guess. And Aqualad, once again, maybe the worst offender of this lingo here, says, "Hey, Robino, how could anyone have as marv a Christmas as we are?" I'm assuming marv is short for marvelous. Yeah. Like I said, really bad dialogue, but a pretty fun story. If you're familiar at all with the Christmas Carol, classic story from Charles Dickens, you'll probably get a kick out of it. Up next, we have a Teen Titans story written by Paul Levitz, classic Teen Titan writer, Juan Luis Garcia Lopez on art. So with Dick Giordano handling the inks, really classic and talented, legendary art team, really, I would say. Ben Oda letters and Jerry Serpe on colors. And we see that Superboy has once again used his powers to fly through time to the year 2979, to the city of Metropolis, Legion headquarters, and it's Christmas time. Superboy's thinking to himself, Legion headquarters is coming together again quickly. It's too bad it couldn't be completed in time for Christmas Day, but I guess that's too big a present to expect from Santa. He notices that Mon-El is guarding the perimeter, saying, you pulled guard duty again, huh? He's like, yeah, I got another 3 hours to go. Superboy heads inside, saying, well, they haven't gotten around to redecorating the old underground passages. You know, it's a real shame. Nobody should have to look at bricks instead of, you know, gay decorations or what have you on Christmas. But there's some mistletoes strung up, and Phantom Girl shows up to take advantage of it and gives Superboy a kiss on the cheek. And Phantom Girl says, oh, sorry if I surprised you. Superboy says, it's fine. Just hope Ultra Boy never makes you apologize for kissing him. And they head into the monitor room where Saturn Girl is on duty. And Superboy wishes Saturn Girl Merry Christmas and says, you know, you're the only person who in the cosmos who would volunteer for extra duty on Christmas Eve. And Saturn Girl says, it's fine, you know? When you're married to another Legionnaire, it's sort of different, right? Garth and I think of the Legion as our home, so where else would we be on Christmas except for here? And then he notices the tree, which is sort of this metal, aluminum kind of thing. And Saturn Girl says, that's our tree, you know? Only one way Christmas is celebrated in the 30th century, and they check in on Karate Kid and Princess Projectra and Sunboy as they celebrate Christmas with an ancient Japanese tea ritual. Meanwhile, Saturn Girl turns the monitor to other planets, and they look at the fireworks tree display on Snurl, which apparently is like a world of squirrels. Chameleon Boy's world of Durla, where Christmas isn't even a holiday, so he's just patrolling space, not knowing any the wiser. Colossal Boy is Jewish, so celebrating Hanukkah there. That's always been a thing. Colossal Boy's always been Jewish. Saturn Girl says the monitor boards can call up a dozen other worlds where they celebrate Christmas in different ways. And Wildfire then walks in the door saying there's 100 different ways of saying it, Superboy, but the message is still peace on Earth. And Superboy says, well, maybe, maybe not, but what's wrong with a simple old-fashioned Christmas with a real tree, not some aluminum monstrosity? He says, I'd trade all your star-spanning futuristic technology for a little tinsel right now. And Wildfire's like, are you overreacting? Like, boy, he is being a little, a little presumptuous, a little condescending. Like, what people celebrate in their own way, right? And then all of a sudden he says, wait a minute, I got a great idea to make all this technology pay off. Let's go find the Star of Bethlehem that blazed over Christmas on that first night where Jesus was born. Saturn Girl goes, oh no, here we go. But apparently he gets them all to agree. With the exception of Mon-El, who has to stay and guard the headquarters. So we've got Saturn Girl, we've got Phantom Girl, we've got Wildfire, as well as Lightning Lad. And they sort of track down where the star should be, but it's not there. But what they do find is a lonely little planet. And Lightning Lad says, I suppose it's academic if anybody wants to take a look around. And so they all take a look and they find that the planet's actually not in the best shape. It seems to be on the verge of an ice age, and these creatures that live in the ocean are having a hard time harvesting the plankton-like weed that grows on the sea's surface that keeps them alive. Basically, their sustenance. It's the cold is freezing over the surface of the water, and they're not able to harvest the plankton to to survive. So Wildfire gives them some help. He picks up some giant chunks of ice and melts them with his powers, and it literally rains plankton down. And he thinks, yeah, that's great. You know, I helped them for now. That food will last them a couple days, but you know, the ice age this planet is entering is going to last for centuries. What to do? Meanwhile, Lightning Lad and Phantom Girl find some of the indigenous life that lives on the land, and they realize that they're literally burning their own crops to stay alive. So they're holding the cold at bay for the short term. But what are they going to have to eat? You know, they're burning their own crops. At some point, they're going to run out of crops to burn. Plus, they don't have anything to eat. So they do save a couple of the land dwellers from the fire, which has sort of grown out of control. But they're kind of stuck in the same predicament that the sea dwellers are. Like, what are we going to do? How are we going to survive long term? Meanwhile, in the high forest, a few more miles in from shore, Superboy is saving some... it's an avian... species that lives there, and he's saving some eggs in giant bird nest from an ice storm that's going on there, using metal he's harvested from the ground, nearby ground, and lashes the nets to the trees, but again wondering, well, this is only a short-term solution. So as the Legionnaires meet back up, they're thinking, you know, what can we do? It's not a pretty picture. And then Superboy has an idea, they head back to their ship, and with a few adjustments, they use their earplug communicators, telepathic earplug communicators that they use to communicate in space, and they give them to the various species there so they can communicate, and they send the various members of the Legion on some missions. So they build some underground caves, give it access to water, and then Superboy sort of reveals his plan to both the Legionnaires as well as the other members of the species, the various members of the species that live on the planet. So his plan is for the species to survive the couple hundred years of the Ice Age, hiding out in these caves that they have created. So because they've given it access to water, and now created a way for these three species to communicate to each other, they can use the cavern as their common home. So they can grow the plankton and the crops on the water in safety. The sea-dwelling species can harvest it. Meanwhile, the land-dwelling species can keep setting fires along the pool's edge to add warmth and keep the water from freezing. And the bird-like species can leave the cavern, fly out, and collect wood from the trees to keep the fires burning in trade for shelter. What's going to happen when they run out of wood? Which, you know, if the Ice Age lasts long enough, you think that would happen. But again, don't put too much logic in it. It's a Silver Age type story. So Superboy says, although none of the three could survive, by working together, they should be able to hang on until the United Nations can arrange a safe evacuation. So I guess the plan is not to actually survive the whole Ice Age, but just survive long enough until the United Planets can come and find a place to relocate them. So I guess that makes sense in a way. And now that the pressing emergency of how these species are going to survive has been resolved, the Legionnaires can start getting back to their original goal, which is to find that star, right? So Superboy seems to have remembered what Christmas is all about, which is not a real tree or the way you celebrate. Because as Phantom Girl says, kind of warms your heart, doesn't it? He says, yeah, that's what Christmas is supposed to be. It's caring, it's helping, and maybe a bright, shining star in the sky that science says is impossible. And Wildfire says, oh, come off it, Superboy. You're not still pushing the star business, huh? Then, well, something brought us here for Christmas Eve, right? So star, no star. The Legionnaires were in the right place at the right time to help out that species. all three species really help out that planet. So, so that does it for the Legion superhero Christmas story. So, pretty straightforward, you know, classic Paul Levitt's tale for sure. Next up, we have Superman and Santa Claus. So DC Comics Presents, which is always Superman teaming up with another hero. This one is written by Len Wein and E. Nelson Bridwell, with Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson, legendary Superman artists, collectively known as Swanderson. Ben Oda on letters and Jerry Serpe on colors. So it starts off with a kid trying to rob a Santa who's standing on a street corner with a kettle, collecting money for the poor. And the kid says, "Okay, Whiskers, stick them up, hand over your money or I'll plug you." And when Santa Claus says, "You know, move along, kid, you bother me," the kid actually shoots Santa in the nose with a dart gun. And he says, "That wasn't funny. You know, this toy might seem harmless, but you can take somebody's eye out with that." And Superman, having seen the exchange, stops and takes the gun from the kid. Using his X-ray vision, he spots a mechanism inside, which is projecting a concentrated radiation, which is hypnotizing the kid. And all the kid can say, he just keeps saying the same thing over and over every few seconds: "Hand over all your money, hand over all your money, hand over, you know, or I'm gonna shoot you," whatever. So Superman says, "You know, where's your home?" And all the kid can reply, "Just hand over all your money." So Superman wraps him in the cape, his cape, takes him to the Fortress of Solitude, where he can break him from the hypnotism. And when he does, he gets the kid's name and finds out that the kid couldn't wait for Christmas, went snooping around in the hall closet, found one of his, a couple of his presents, actually, a spaceship toy and this dart gun. And he remembers the first time he fired off the dart gun, there being a blinding flash. And next thing he remembers is waking up in the Fortress of Solitude. So certainly seems like somebody is hypnotizing kids. And Superman wants to know, well, what was the message that you heard the first time when the gun flashed? But the kid can't remember. So Superman hypnotizes him again and asks him to repeat the taped message that he heard. And he says, he repeats the message, which finishes up with, "When you've rescued all the money from the evil Grinch disguised as Santa Claus, you will deliver it to your local Big Shot toy store. Then our little game will be over and you'll remember nothing." So obviously the work of the toy man, which, you know, when you see toys having been tampered with, I don't know why you would even need to hear the message. You got to think toy man immediately. So Superman says, "I should have known he was behind this. It has his insane imprint all over it." So Superman says, "All right, let me wrap you back up in my cape and take you home, and then I'll go talk to the toy man." So as they start to fly away from the Fortress of Solitude, Timmy is holding that other toy he got in his hand. Now, why Superman didn't take it from him or examine it, I don't know. But anyway, it shoots Superman, and he falls to the ground, twisting at the last moment, right before he loses consciousness, to protect Timmy from the fall. So Timmy, although wrapped in Superman's cape, knows that he's going to freeze to death out there if they stay for too long. He tries to wake up Superman and is unable to. And just as he starts to lose all hope, we see some elves show up. So they haul Superman off as Timmy's asking, "Who are you guys? Who are you guys?" And the response is, "This is the North Pole, Sonny. We'll give you three guesses." So we'll come back to them in a minute. But meantime, at the Shot toy store, he's kind of annoyed that his picture has faded into snow. Apparently, not only did that spaceship that Timmy was holding that zapped Superman have the power to stop Superman, it also had a camera in it. And Shot's like, "Man, I really wanted to see Superman plunge to his icy death. Oh, I guess I shouldn't complain. I've been on a great streak lately, finding that old meteorite laced with white dwarf star matter that allowed me to create these new deadly toys." And they cancel Superman's powers, which had him flying like a concrete kite. "Plus, I've got all these kids bringing me all this money, and things are going to be even easier without Superman's interference. So, you know, I'm really happy with the way things have gone. And should Superman survive, the terrible toy man will be ready for him, because I have all these toys guarding me that are also equipped with this white dwarf star, heavy matter, or what have you. So meanwhile, we see Superman waking up, and he is indeed in Santa's workshop. We see Santa Claus there. Superman expressing the impossibility of it, saying, you know, I've had a headquarters in the North Pole for years, and I've never seen you before, with Santa saying, well, because I didn't want you to see me. I can have complete control over that. Didn't want you to know I was here, so you didn't know. Timmy's also surprised. He didn't necessarily believe in Santa either, but the proof is right in front of their eyes. So Santa gives him a tour, shows him their now computerized area where they monitor the kids to see who's naughty and who's nice, which it's a little Orwellian when you think about it. It's a little Big Brother. But they take a peek at the toy man and realize that he is preparing for Superman should they attack. And Santa is worried that all these toy man toys that have been distributed are going to be harmful, and it's going to give him a bad name and hurt the kids, which is what he really cares about. So what they decide to do is to swap out the toys that the toy man has distributed, and Superman charges Santa with also returning Timmy home. And Santa's worried, like, well, Superman, you were just knocked out not too long ago. Are you sure you're going to be okay? Yeah, you know, I'll be fine. I'll go gather up the Toy Man toys. But as they're flying, Superman flying along the sleigh, Santa in his sleigh pulled by the reindeer, Superman ends up having to hitch a ride because he is still affected by the dark or the white dwarf star matter, rather. So their first stop is the Big Shot toy store, where all entrances are guarded except the chimney. So Superman flies down the chimney pulling a Santa Claus himself, and is nearly overwhelmed by all the toys that are basically infused with this white dwarf star matter. But Santa and his elves are there. They release their toys, which have been built to counteract the toys of the toy man. And toy man's like, where are these other toys coming from? I'm not sure. But they managed to be enough to give Superman the edge. Meanwhile, Santa Claus uses some marbles he brought along to cause the toy man to slip and fall as he's trying to make his escape. And I don't think Toy Man ever even gets to see Santa Claus. Doesn't realize that Santa Claus is real. But the police soon show up, summoned by Superman, which allows Superman to then check the records of the Toy Man to see where those Toy Man toys that are infused with the white dwarf matter are. And he then goes and gathers them all up and replaces them with the same type of toy, just without all the mechanisms inside that have been given to him by Santa Claus. And then as Superman goes to grab Timmy and take him home safely, Timmy's spaceship, which, again, why does he still have this spaceship that has the white dwarf star matter in it if all the others have been swapped out? Wouldn't you want to have taken that away from Timmy? But Superman gets zapped again, and when he comes to, they're back in the snow, back at the North Pole, and it leaves Superman wondering, did all that stuff really happen or not? And Superman's saying, yeah, I remember it was the wildest dream. There were reindeers and elves and Santa Claus. Do you believe in Santa Claus, Timmy? Timmy, having expressed him not having believed earlier, says, of course I believe in Santa Claus, Superman, don't you? So we're left to wonder, did it really happen or not? And Timmy's just playing along and pretending that it didn't and it was a dream, because that's what Santa told him to do. So Superman does drop Timmy off at home and wishes Superman a Merry Christmas. And as Superman flies back to his apartment and reaches into his secret cape pocket for his clothes, what he finds is an old hollow toy, just like the one his father made for him when he was a baby, one that he thought was destroyed. And he was reminiscing about it earlier in the story, which is kind of a hint that what he thought was just a dream really happened, because when he turns it on, the hologram that is produced is Santa Claus holding a banner saying Merry Christmas, Superman. So a really great story, really kind of heartfelt and wonderful. It kind of reminds you of the Tim Allen Santa Claus movies, where it turns out Santa is real. And, you know, you really can't think of two more enduring symbols of hope and happiness and togetherness than Superman and Santa Claus. So I love the fact that there's a holiday story with those two teaming up. And of course, the villain is the Toy Man. You know, who else would it be? In terms of the art, I mean, it's Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson. There's no more iconic look for a huge generation, maybe two generations of Americans. When you think of Superman, this is who you're thinking of. This is, you know, what you saw on merchandise and advertisements and things like that. It's the Kurt Swan version of Kurt Swan inked by Murphy Anderson version of Superman. So very classic. Okay, the last story, another real famous holiday story from DC, The Silent Night of the Batman. And just like the first story was a Batman story, we're ending the issue with a Batman story, with Batman out on patrol Christmas Eve in Gotham. The sidewalks bustle with last-minute shoppers and a peaceful, almost heavenly scene. Would injustice and tragedy dare creep in? There's too much contrary experience for Batman to believe otherwise. So he gets summoned by the Bat Signal to the headquarters of the Gotham City Police Department, and he thinks, well, here we go. Even though it's Christmas Eve, crime doesn't take a holiday. So he shows up there. Jim Gordon's waiting for him. He says, what's the emergency? And Jim Gordon says, quite the opposite, actually. I called you in for Christmas Eve because it's not a night for you to be out patrolling. It is the season to be jolly. And Batman says, well, you know, like the saying goes, you know it and I know it. Now tell them, because crime and disaster aren't really inclined to observe holidays. And Commissioner Gordon says, you know what? Tonight's going to be different. I know it. With Batman thinking, he sounds almost inspired, but nothing ever happens just by saying it. And so we see the officers in the precinct decorating their tree, with one of them saying, hey, Batman, you know, why don't you help out by contributing your deep vocal cords to some Christmas carols? And Batman thinks, you know what? Why not enjoy myself until something happens? And they break into a rousing rendition of Jingle Bells, followed by We Three Kings of Orient Are, and interspersed while the interspersed within the panels while the officers and Batman are singing are a few different scenes unfolding in Gotham that night. So we see a woman whose package is stolen by a street urchin, and he takes it over to his gang members. They open it up, and it's a Batman doll. And seeing it all, they're reminded of the Dark Knight and how what they've done is wrong. And so the boy wraps it back up and gives it back to the woman before running off into the night. Likewise, we see a man with a gun, apparently on his way to rob something, who bumps into someone in a Batman costume. And as they turn, it's a hybrid Batman, Santa Claus person who's wearing a sign around their deck saying, support Wayne Foundation Christmas Drive for the Blind. This man, once again reminded, just like the boy was, of Batman and the spirit of the season, throws his gun in a garbage can and heads for home, I would assume. Meanwhile, back at the precinct, the officers and Batman have now moved on to Santa Claus is coming to town, making a list and checking it twice, while a woman is reading a letter from her husband, who apparently is overseas in the military. She's feeling very despondent about spending Christmas alone, and she heads to a bridge where we wonder, is she about to commit suicide? And just as she's about to maybe make a terrible choice, her husband shows up back from overseas so they can celebrate Christmas together. Finally, the officers and Batman have moved on to Silent Night, Holy Night, singing that classic hymn, and Batman realizes it's 6 o'clock. They've been singing there all night. I mean, I don't know how all night, like a couple hours maybe. But Batman does realize we haven't been disturbed by one report of robbery, murder, drug peddling, anything. It's like the spirit of Christmas took hold on everyone. And Commissioner Gordon wonders, was it the spirit of Christmas, Batman, or the spirit of Batman himself? And Batman thinks he's been seeing things like, wait, what's going on? And Commissioner Gordon says, you know, we've been here all night singing and not a single call has come in. Maybe your investment in the city has paid off, giving you the night off. So Batman heads for home. Thinking about that investment, the spirit of Batman, the Christmas spirit. Again, very, very famous holiday story for Batman. Written by Mike Friedrich. We have Neil Adams and Dick Giordano on art. And I really do think that's part of the reason it's so classic. You know, that the Neil Adams art is Neil at the height of his powers here. And it's just a really fun story. And not necessarily a story that would work as well these days. Batman has become so different than he was back in this era. So much more than he was then. And I think a little bit to the detriment of the character. He's less relatable, I think, to the other officers of Gotham City. A little less human, in my opinion. So, anyway, that's the final story in this Christmas with the Superhero special. I was really happy when I bought this back in 1988. I love Christmas time, and it was great to revisit some of these stories. This was the first time that I had ever read them. Back then, I guess I was, 13, 14 years old. This was the first time I got to read a lot of these stories, and it was just a great celebration of Christmas, a great cross-section. I think I remember at the time liking the Teen Titans story the least, and I think I liked the Superman story the most. Legion Superhero one, rather, was kind of the corniest of them. And I remember as a kid, even then, thinking that, you know, killing Santa off in that Justice League story was harsh, man. It was brutal. Overall, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed seeing these Christmas stories being celebrated, and my favorite holiday showing up in the pages of a comic magazine. So I hope you enjoyed this kind of walk down memory lane with these classic Christmas tales from DC Comics history. Hope you're having a safe and happy holiday, and hope you enjoy all the tons of 12 Days of the Comic Source episodes that we're releasing for you this holiday season. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.